The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you all for being here. What I think we're going to do is we're going to all sort of take about 5 minutes and say a little something about what we've written and how we got into that, and then maybe have a conversation and open it up for questions a little bit. Alexandra, I have read and really enjoyed your book. Why don't you tell everyone a little bit about it?
Sure. I've written a book called Inside of a Dog. This really started from two directions. One, my being a dog owner myself and having the natural questions every dog owner has about my dog's experience, especially when I'm not there to supervise her experience, what she thinks about, what she understands, what she does, etc. Most of these questions were left as questions in my dog-owning days. But then I became also a researcher into animal behavior and started to study dogs professionally, which I didn't think was something I was going to be able to do. There was no such field as, you know, dog cognition, but as I was in graduate school, such a field started to emerge, and I was lucky enough to be riding that wave. And so I was on this wave of research looking into what dogs think about and understand from a psychological perspective. And at some point I decided, gee, maybe I could start to try to answer some of these questions I have as a dog owner using the science, my own, but many other researchers, that has emerged. And so this book is that attempt.
Susanna, we just met backstage,
yes.
And Puzzle is here, too. Why don't you tell everyone a little bit about what you wrote?
Okay. I wrote Scent of the Missing, Love, and Partnership with a Search and Rescue Dog. And really, the challenge of... It's about the challenge of bringing out the best in an intelligent, spirited dog who would have to be both a search and rescue partner and a family companion. That was the job I had bringing Puzzle home and raising her. It was also the challenge I had writing the book, which attempts to bring readers into that double experience, because it's a wild experience. You bring home these high-energy puppies who are genetically programmed to want to work. I mean, they've got it in 200 and 300 and 400 years of their background. And you teach them to... I'm sorry, I think the feedback is squeaking in our ears. You teach them that they've got to find human scent, living and dead, 100% of the time, no mistake. And at the same time, we form a partnership that has to be able to go home and merge with children or with other pets in the house. And sometimes there's a friction between that working partnership and that home companionship. My journey was a little bit harder, even because Puzzle, a golden retriever known as a breed that is overtly friendly, excessively friendly, didn't like me. She didn't like me at all when she first met me, and I adored her. I'd waited 3 years for her, and she didn't like me. And it probably took her about, 5 months to remotely like me and probably a year to truly love me. And that hurt. But, you know, even through all of that, the respect and the drive to work was never a problem. So it really was a double relationship for the longest time. So Scent of the Missing is about that period when our partnership formed and when love and trust somehow evolved. Along the way, as I was training her, the book covers also case study searches that I worked as an assistant beside other dogs and handlers who were already certified. These were searches after abduction, disaster, crime, and misadventure. These were searches that taught me something that I would need to bring back to my training with Puzzle and the partnership we would need to be able to achieve.
I was a reporter at the Inquirer. I live here in Philadelphia. And I suspect that, like both of you guys, I'm a beneficiary of the publishing industry, having seen the enormous success of my former colleague John Grogan's book, Marley and Me, deciding that anything where you can put a dog on the cover is going to, like, buy some publisher a country house someplace. And the dirty little secret I never told them during my meetings when I was selling my book proposal was that I had this book idea called One Nation Underdog, and it wasn't really about dogs. It was about people, and it sort of began with the story of my getting a dog and never having had a dog before, and kind of like anyone sort of coming into a new environment, just looking around at what my friends and neighbors were doing in terms of how they raised and lived with their pets and copying them. And it all seemed very normal to me. To members of my family who had had dogs going way back, it all seemed really, really, really bizarre. Particularly when we had gotten our dog from a shelter and he had a lot of trouble adjusting to life in our house, and the vet in our neighborhood said, well, gee, you know, a lot of people use antidepressants. And, you know, we said, all right. And, you know, we should all be so lucky as to have the benefits that our dog has had, and it sort of, not alone, but with a bunch of other stuff, has led to a really happy situation at home. But this was sort of one example of how people do things that, at least where we are pretty normal, that weren't particularly normal until quite recently. And, you know, people, my Uncle Frank would say, what the hell is wrong with this country when even our dogs are popping pills? But, you know, my hunch here is that the dogs haven't changed. They're the same critters they've always been. You're the evolutionary expert, so you might be able to say otherwise. But it's not them that's changed, it's us. And, you know, as a journalist, you know, I sort of feel that when the definition of normal changes that fast and that much, it's an indication that some pretty interesting things are going on in the culture. And I set out to write this book where I sort of looked at the evolution of how we live with and care for pets and thought a little bit about how that reflected the pretty vast changes in our human society that ostensibly have nothing to do with pets, and how we kind of project those changes on pets. And I wound up sort of one part being a journalist and looking at, like, you know, who's making money off this, and one part meditating about what it all means, and one part just taking a tour of American puppy mania for a couple of years, which was a lot of fun. I used to cover City Hall here in Philadelphia, and running around after crazy dog people all across the country was a lot more fun than that. We have pretty different books here, and yet I think there's some areas of overlap. And I would like to start with Alexandra. One of the things that I thought was really, really interesting in my book, as I did my research, was looking at the history of dog training, which has changed really dramatically over the years, from it being this rote, you know, aggressive, you know, whack the dog if it does something wrong, to this much more positive, gentle, nurturing form of pedagogy. And it kind of, to my mind, it sort of mirrors the change in how we educate children. But I want to know if you, in looking at dogs' brains, you know, there are these heated arguments between dog trainers, you know, about who's cruel and who's not cruel. I had a much harder time getting at good data about who's effective. And I'm wondering if you had thoughts, in a vacuum, what you think is sort of the most effective way of teaching a dog something.
Well, you know, ironically, the psychologists or people studying dogs cognitively aren't really the ones training them. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not ironic. Maybe that's not a coincidence at all. But, you know, anyone who has a psychology background will say dogs learn the way all mammals learn, the way we learn, at the foundation, which is conditioned responses, making associations between things. So a dog will learn by being punished, absolutely, and a dog will learn by being rewarded. Now, what they will learn to do, they can learn to do a behavior equally well, but what the motivator is behind that is going to be different. So you might have fear as a motivator to do a behavior, or you might have excitement or anticipation as a motivator to do behavior. So I think, depending on the problem, I would condone or disapprove of these of various methods. In fact, I can only really condone positive reinforcement methods. I don't see almost any reason ever to use positive, what's called positive punishment, hitting a dog or scolding your dog. But it would still work in some way to get the desired effect, you know, a dog, because a dog will operate like any of us would, out of fear as much as out of anticipation. Incidentally, I just recently been looking at some dog training manuals from the late 19th century, which is when I first seen these obedience manuals, and some of them are surprisingly similar to the ones we see today. I mean, a lot of them talk about how a dog will do anything for a little bit of kibble, you know, so you always have a bit of liver. Wherever you go, always smell a little bit like liver. I mean, and they're doing essentially the same thing as a lot of the trainers today, only in addition to getting a dog to sit and come and stay, they were also asking dogs to do things like play cards, which doesn't seem to be one of the big hobbies now with dogs.
How'd that work out?
I'm not sure how effective it was, but the method was taught.
So, Susanna, what did you do with as you trained a Puzzle?
Well, with search and rescue, we generally say, there are teams that run exceptions, but we generally say that you never use negative correction. You'll hear some people say there are no no's in search training, because the truth is you cannot force a dog to search. Scent, human scent, is invisible to us, and they could certainly go through the motions quite believably, and we would never know the difference. And so it's a drive behind them and a generosity of spirit that has them go into often very dangerous and cataclysmic situations in the first place. And so we reward them for doing the right thing, and when they make a mistake, we'll say, that's not it. You know, find more or you know, find that or whatever. And they very quickly get it. You know, when I've made a mistake, I know it, and I go on until I get it right. And what happens is you get very happy dogs that are eager to go out in the field, sometimes more eager than the humans are, and they teach us a lot in that regard. And so with Puzzle, you know, one of the tricks is you have to find out what motivates the dog. You know, you were talking about liver. And some dogs are very ball-driven. We've got dogs on the team that will do anything for a tennis ball. And you know, they will find a victim and then go, oh, yep, there, and then turn around and look at the handle like, give me the ball, give me the ball, give me the ball. You've got other dogs that are treat-driven, and they'll make the find of the victim and turn around to the handler, give me the treat, give me the treat, give me the treat. With Puzzle, the difficulty was she will play with the ball in the backyard, but the minute I took it out in search training and tried to throw it after a find, she looked at me like, are you out of your mind? You know, this is what we do at home. She was like, you go get the ball. I don't want it. And then I tried treats, and she'll take a treat, but it's really more as a politeness to me. What I learned is that Puzzle is motivated by praise, and she's motivated by the job. Often after a search, what she really wants is another quick little find as her reward, which was not something that was in any of our game plan. We had to figure that out. She's the only dog on the team that way. But if I want to keep her really motivated and really happy, she makes a find, and then she goes and gets to make another little one. So we'll have a police officer hide or something like that. It was, yeah, please, my dog needs a reward, and she's not interested in the steakums, you know, so, or the tennis ball.
So one of the things that I was interested in as I was doing research for this book was the sort of the kind of social promotion that a lot of people have given to their pets, turning them into sort of ersatz children and full-fledged members of the family. And, you know, you can see this in all kinds of cool places. I found one study that had been done in a scholarly magazine about business history that looked at images of pets in, like, glossy women's magazines through the 20th century. And, you know, the kind of prototypical image of the 1920s was, like, you know, stylish woman on the street walking her dog. And by the 50s, it had it had come into to the living room where there'd be sort of dog curled up in front of the fireplace as the family watched TV or something. And as you get into the end of the 20th century, it was a Robitussin ad where the dog is actually on the bed with the kid and mom is delivering Robitussin. And, you know, you see it's like manifest destiny. They're like, you know, getting closer and closer and closer. One place I visited was the oldest pet cemetery in the country in Hartsdale in Westchester County. And you actually see it on the headstones. If you look at the oldest headstones, it'll say, like, you know, here lies Rover, a loyal servant, or something like that. And as you get into the middle of the 20th century, it's much more likely to be, you know, my best friend or man's best friend or something like that. And the most contemporary ones, and any of these online pet tribute websites you see, it's all, you know, mommy and daddy miss you and our little girl and our little boy. But, you know, it occurs to me that each of these things that we're saying, you know, whether it's you know, loyalty and servitude, or whether it's friendship, or whether it's filial love, are kind of our projections onto their motivations. And I'm wondering if either of you guys have thoughts on how much of that is genuine. I mean, from the dog's point of view, do they think of themselves as full members of the family, or as do they feel loyalty as we humans understand it?
Woohoo! I know I've seen a demonstration of loyalty in the face of events where it would be much easier for the dog to have run. Certainly, loyalty to me. There's an episode in the book that I don't want to disclose too much, but there was an episode in the book where she was quite young and I was injured. And she made a choice that would have been contrary to everything she was doing as a young dog then. She made a choice to stay beside me. And I think it wasn't her choosing out of her best interests. I think she was genuinely concerned about me. And it was the first hint I got that we might be forming some kind of relationship. I think she thinks of herself as one of the family, as a dog would define family, you know, that social group of people who look after each other in one way or another. We give something, they give something back. But I think it is, she understands a two-way partnership. It's just not, I don't think she thinks of it in human terms.
Yeah, I agree that a dog definitely has a family if a dog were wild, and would just define the humans around him or her as that family. So a dog, certainly, I have no doubt, feels association, feels affinity, feels closeness. Would a dog ever define that as, or feel loyalty? No. I don't see why they would feel that way. That's a human concept. Mm-hmm. Do they act loyal? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I think when we're calling them loyal, that's not incorrect. But to imagine that that's the dog's experience of his own behavior is where we go awry. And in my book, I try to talk about that type of dissociation without trying to say dogs don't love us or dogs don't feel any of the ways we think they feel. I think it's much more interesting to appreciate the richness of their life, of their interior life, from their point of view, mm-hmm. as opposed to always planting our point of view on them.
I totally agree with that. I mean, that's absolutely the way I see it as well.
And I think this is the way that you say, you know, there are stages, there are cultural stages about how we've treated dogs, and now we're really indulging them and treating them like little, furry, less sophisticated people, and overindulged, less sophisticated people. In a way, I think the next step might be a different type of indulgence, really imagining their life, taking the time to imagine what's actually going to improve. She disagrees vehemently. That's the next generation.
That's my daughter.
Is that your daughter?
You know, I think having the time and liberty to really think about how can I improve my dog's life, imagining what my dog wants, not what I the costume I would like to see my dog in. I think that's something that's about that we're evolving into as a culture.
But I think that would be a really good thing to evolve into.
I think it would be an improvement.
Do you see signs that that has sort of taken hold, and you know, what forms would that take in terms? I mean, there is this enormous economy of like goods and services for pets that I've spent a lot of time exploring. How would that world of the pet industry change if people
It wouldn't have as much of a commercial manifestation. Mm-hmm. But for instance, I know of a couple of camps, for instance, where you can bring your. In fact, I'm going to one in June where you called Camp Unleashed, where the humans and dogs go and spend time together just romping around. And the dogs are all off-leash. And for many dogs, this will be probably the longest time that they have off-leash. So in a way, that's a kind of indulgence in time and in money and so forth. But it's much more imagining what the dog is interested in. So maybe things like that, or even legislation or cities or towns realizing that the ways we deal with dogs have to be a little more dog-centered from the city side, as opposed to, you know, you put every dog on a leash, or here's the 2 square feet where you're allowed to have your dog off the leash, et cetera. So that might be a move that I could imagine, and there's some signs of that.
Right. I get the sense that the institutions of society, they do sort of slowly move towards how humans live, and one change in how humans have lived is that their dogs are much more important to them. Mm-hmm. So it stands to reason that the people who make decisions about, you know, what's allowed in your neighborhood park are going to ultimately, slowly and maybe in a lagging way, reflect the interests of the people who are using the park and the people who are voting for them or not voting for them. And I guess it's no surprise to me that the places that have been most ahead of the curve on this, like in San Francisco, where there was this enormous sort of political agita over dog parks, and there was a group called Dog Pack. They would march on City Hall and, you know, threaten to unelect council members who don't vote the way they want them to vote. That's also a place where, according to the census, at least there are more dogs than children, because it's, you know, really expensive to have a child in San Francisco. But for whatever reason, it just means that. You know, if you're looking out at your constituency, if you're in politics and you're thinking about how to set rules for people and dogs, you're probably going to think, you know, I better give this some serious thought and not just treat it as like a potential menace. You know, I think one way that people are sort of trying to organize their time around their dogs is there is a lot of participation in rescue activities and search activities, not just from a, you know, this is a canine dog from the police department, but you know, this is somebody who on their weekends likes to go out and do stuff like this.
Right.
I visited a place in Texas where people would sort of do that just for fun on weekends.
And, oh, like scent work and things?
Right. Mm-hmm. And some of the people you work with fit that description too?
Well, not everybody that works search and rescue certainly is law enforcement. Mm-hmm. I would say probably 2/3 of us come from a military background or law enforcement or more often first responder background. But every once in a while, you'll have someone who is passionate about working with a dog and very respectful about what the dog brings to the table that we do not. And we've got a fabulous dog handler who is, in fact, an accountant. She's got one of the best dogs on the team, a high-drive, super successful dog, and an accountant running behind her. But she came into this with a respect for Belle that was mutual, and, yeah, it translated into a passionate level of service.
Just don't go missing on April 14th.
That's right, yeah.
I want to, if anyone has any questions, I'll open it up. We can keep talking amongst ourselves, but I'd be very happy to. Please. You know, there's someone coming with a microphone.
Ms. Horowitz, I was very intrigued by your comment about, or I don't know if you said it or somebody said it about your book, about what dogs think about all day. So that's,
right.
I've had that thought a lot. Like when I leave to go to work and he's there all day by himself, what's he thinking about? Is he thinking, I can't wait till she comes home. I can't wait till she comes home. Or is he just, oh, I'm going to go to sleep. Who cares? You know, so.
Yeah, now, the science has unfortunately been quiet on this issue, but I can't imagine why, because I do find it enormously interesting. It seems to me that dogs get, they show every sign of being bored, just as we imagine they might be. I mean, we kind of have an epidemic of dogs oversleeping, The dogs don't need to sleep for 16 or 18 hours a day. They sleep because we're not giving them something else to do. But there are a lot of changes that happen in your house during the day that the dog might be alert to and interested in. So a lot of what I talk about in my book comes from just looking into the biology of how the dog's nose works and how their ears work and what they're attuned to. And they really are able to attend to a level of detail in just ordinary life that we do not attend to. And so there might be some engagement in that. So, you know, warm air moves through the house in the day. As it does, it brings currents of odor on it that might come in from the window, spread across the floor, come up the walls, go across the ceiling and back out the window. That happens every day in every room. We never notice it. But a dog sitting there all day with nothing to do might get engaged by something like that. The types of noises that come from outside that for us are ordinary noises because we can immediately define it and dismiss it. A door closing, a lawnmower going, other dogs passing. These might be highlights for your dog who is just looking for something to attend to. And when we'll notice it, there aren't ordinary things. So my guess is they're bored and looking for using their senses to try to see and sense as much as they can through the day.
Ms. Horowitz, I just bought your book yesterday, and it's fantastic. I love it. Inside a Dog, everybody buy it.
Thank you.
And you might touch on this. I didn't get to it yet if you do, but everybody says that my little 2-year-old Havanese is neurotic because I'm neurotic. And I'm just wondering, is that true that our dogs do pick up on our personalities that much? Because that's what everybody tells me. So I try to be calmer around her, but it's not working. And, so I don't know.
I think it's not.
Thank you.
Sure. I'm glad you're enjoying the book. I think it's not unlikely to see dogs and owners who correspond in temperament for two reasons. One, owners might be attracted to dogs who have recognizable features. On just a first meeting, might be more interested in a dog which is running around than one who looks like he's sleeping all the time. And they will feed off our energy at some level, right? Now, I could say that there's a biological foundation to that, and that foundation would be probably hormonal. That is, if you're stressed a lot, you're giving off a lot of cortisol all the time, the dog can sense this. It's a little bit contagious. There's some evidence that dogs will pick up on and sort of internalize the stress that they're feeling from their owners. Now, if that's a temperamental trait and not just an episodic trait, I don't know if there's any evidence that a dog actually grows into your personality. But certainly they'll feed off of some of the dynamic, and I would say hormones is what the dynamic is, that you exude.
I think there was someone waiting in the middle.
I'm wondering, about the science of knowing, figuring out what dogs think, how that science works, since we have a hard time even knowing what another person is thinking. And I guess related to that is, I'm wondering what science knows already about how dogs handle stress. And I know that there's a certain amount of stress that my dog probably has to deal with in terms of right turn on red traffic or being in really tricky traveling situations. So I'd be interested in anything about how dogs handle stress and how we can help them handle it.
Sure. Suzanne, do you want to? I mean, you might know something about that, I'd say.
Well, we were just talking about this in the green room because my puzzle down here has been in her working vest for 7 days straight now. And to her, the vest means that she's about to go surge. But the airlines require it, the train travel requires it, most of the places that allow her to come inside all want her in her vest. And I told someone the day before yesterday, it was like putting a surgeon in a room, having the surgeon scrub up and telling him, you may be about to do surgery sometime soon. And for 7 days, leaving him or her there. And so Puzzle, you know, for 7 days has been pretty much ready to go to work and really bewildered as to why that command has never come. And I think it has given her some stress. I would, looking at your dog down here, I would totally agree that watching these dogs handle these tricky situations, they seem to me to demonstrate certain stress behaviors, and they also figure out what they need to do to overcome them. And if we're acute and pay attention, we can see them seek out their forms of comfort and relaxation. I know with Puzz, the minute she does a practice search, I can literally watch the stress roll off her shoulders. So the first thing that's going to happen when we get home to Dallas tonight is I'm going to ask probably our dog sitter to go hide in the big double section of our yard. We've got a bunch of little outbuildings. And I'll take the vest off Puzz, and I'll give her the command, and literally you can see it roll off her shoulders. And so different dogs do different things, but I think they tell us, and if we pay attention, we know what they need. Does that make sense?
Yeah, can I just, I'll just address this first part of your question, too. I mean, I would just add, I think it's very individual. Being off work would, in whatever way your dog wants to, is the time that he will learn to relax. But as to the question of how we know what a dog is thinking, we don't really, just you're exactly right, as we don't know what other humans are thinking. But we make this leap and imagine that we do every day, and it's because we think we know about enough about other people. We know more or less what they can see and smell and hear. We know more or less what their cognitive abilities are. We might get some information about their level of education or their background. We use all that to make a little leap into imagining what they might be thinking about or what it might be like to be that person. And so I think if we inform ourselves about the biology and cognitive abilities of dogs, we can at least make an informed imaginative leap into what it might be like to be a dog.
Hi, I was wondering how and when people first thought that dogs see in black and white. Because you can't, like, be a dog. How would people first think that?
Well, there were actually some early studies. It's a good question, and implicit in that question is that it's false that dogs just see in black and white. As you probably know, dogs do see in colors, but we all thought that dogs just see in black and white because some early psychologists tested their ability to discriminate between pieces of paper which had different colors on them. The dogs were rewarded, had learned that if they did a discrimination task, telling two different pieces of paper apart correctly, they'd get some food. So then they gave them new pieces of paper with different colors and asked if they would try to get the reward by choosing, you know, the pieces of paper which looked different. And they failed at this task. So psychologists said, aha, it's because they can't tell the difference, because certainly if they could tell the difference between, say, red and green, they would tell us that they, you know, see the difference, and they'd get their bit of kibble. Turned out these experiments must have been pretty flawed, because now having, with finer-tuned experiments, we can tell that if you ask a dog who's trained to discriminate between two different colors, if it sees a difference, they can do it. And we also know a lot about the biology of the dog's eyes, and that they have the same types of cells that our eyes have. They just have some fewer of the cells which allow them to see, would allow them to see sort of yellows and oranges. So they aren't very good at discriminating those colors.
Along that side.
One of the groups that doesn't seem to have noticed what's happened with dogs and people are rescue groups. Living in the city, and I've talked to other people in the city, we have a great deal of trouble getting adopting dogs from rescue groups who think if you don't have a backyard, a fenced-in backyard, you shouldn't be allowed to adopt these dogs. And also there are groups in Philadelphia, or the outskirts of Philadelphia, that will only adopt in their little community. Now, these groups are putting a lot of dogs down. They don't seem to understand that in Center City we have dog parks. We take our dogs to off-leash parks. And they don't seem to understand what's changed. How can we help them understand this?
I think you can do a couple things. And I'll say this. I spent a couple of years doing research for my book, and I found this incredible duality about the world of pets, where there are people who are market researchers who can tell you, like, exactly how many different brands of high-end organic dog shampoo hit the market in the year 2004. But they can't tell you any but the vaguest, fuzziest terms where pets come from in the country. How many actually were sold, how many were bred in mass breeders, how many came through different kinds of shelters, how many dogs are put down in shelters. And the reason for that is that the business of where dogs come from, it's not, I don't mean to say all breeders are bad or anything like that, but there's just a lot of ugly stuff that goes on. And if you are a big retail brand, you don't want to be associated with that, because, you know, it might be fine 9 days out of 10, but on the 10th there'll be a scandal, and you don't want everyone to say, aha, you know, Joe's Pet Shop, you know, they're really involved in this scandal. As a result of that, there is this sort of large and unpoliced world of, unpoliced is the wrong word, but this large and very diverse world of shelters, staffed usually, almost always, by incredibly dedicated, hardworking people who could be doing something else that's more glamorous and better paying. And, you know, people bring with them their values from wherever they, whatever their background is. And, you know, and I think a lot of people do discriminate against those who live in cities, those who live in apartments, those who don't have the sort of traditional backyard and picket fence kind of background. Not all places do that by any means, but some do. I found that a lot of shelters have kind of upgraded over the last 10 years. Because they, you know, realized that one of the biggest things that keeps the puppy mill business going is this perception that to adopt a dog, you have to, you know, drive to a bad part of town, and you have to go through all these hoops, and you have to be vetted in all these ways, and that it's just a pain in the butt. They don't want to investigate it, and they don't want to have anything to do with it, and it's much easier to just go to the mall and go into the pet shop. And some of the smarter shelters, like Paws here, and I visited one in Chicago. It was also called Paws. That you know, it looked like a Restoration Hardware. It was this beautiful facility, like the nicest retail space you'll go in every day. The people who work there take great time with you. They didn't, you know, they might say, hey, if you don't have a backyard, you might want to stay away from this dog or this dog, because these dogs, you know, in our observation of them, tend to be really active. But they. They sort of saw themselves as, hey, the friendlier we make our facility, the better, the cleaner, nicer we make our facility, the fewer people will wind up patronizing pet stores, which keep the puppy mills going. So all I can say is look for a shelter like that, because they're, you know, they're doing good work, and they're doing good work in a way that's gonna help you and help the city. Sure.
One of the things that's happening is that organizations like Paws are putting out their smaller dogs to rescue groups. The rescue groups come in and take 10 or 12 of the smaller dogs, so that Paws has more room for pit bulls and other dogs like that to get them adopted. These rescue groups each have their own individual application, and they're the ones that are more likely to be strict on backyards. I filled out 15 separate applications from 15 different rescue groups to get a small dog, and 13 of them wouldn't adopt to anybody in Center City. So, yes, Paws is more liberal, but the rescue groups to whom they give their dogs aren't necessarily.
I think one of the really interesting things of the last 20 years or so is that the spay-neuter campaign, which had, you know, seemed like this really weird thing when it was first launched, and Bob Barker would talk about it on The Price is Right, and you know, it's like, what's that guy talking about, has actually become, in certain places, become so successful that there are not very many dogs available for adoption that aren't, you know, pit bulls, which rightly or wrongly a lot of people don't want. And so there's this kind of sort of underground railroad system where dogs are brought up from the South and from the Midwest, from agricultural areas, to big coastal cities where there's not enough dogs for adoption. I'm not sure about how it works with the rescue groups or anything, but I just mean that the sort of history of the last 20 years has led to this perverse situation where there's a premium on unwanted dogs of certain breeds, at least. And I think you're sort of falling victim to that scarcity, and that's really too bad because you seem to really want to do well by dogs. And you know, I live in University City, but I live in a really small row house with no backyard. And we went on Pet Finder and we found a Saint Bernard, and he lives with us, and it's a great row house dog. I mean, it's like having a big Ottoman that sheds a lot. But it's, you know, someone who had been more persnickety might have decided that we weren't eligible, and that really would have been too bad. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm hearing one more question. So, right here.
We have a dog that is part Golden Retriever. But the question I have is, or I'm going to relate this. When I read the newspaper, I get excited, meaning, why are they thinking that way? Who elected this person anyway? You know, kind of noises and stuff. And my dog always comes and tries to get me to pay attention to him. And I think he's responding to the emotion that he hears or senses from me. And I don't know whether I don't see other dogs doing that, and it's either me or it's the dog or both, but I'm not sure.
Well, it's the two of you, really, together. Your dog is responding to your outcry, either with concern or maybe interest in getting you to spend all that energy paying attention to him instead. You know, so it could be worry over, you know, if you start just yelling over what to him appears to be nothing. I mean, newspaper, that doesn't have a lot of salience for a dog. So you've suddenly had an outburst. If I was a dog who, you know, loved you and was worried about you, I'd go see what was going on. And I might be a little agitated myself. Anyone else want to weigh in on that?
I was just going to add, in search and rescue, the high voice, the high shrieky voice, is the praise voice, which is pretty funny when you have a 230-pound firefighter with a deep voice trying to go, good dog, woohoo, good dog, because it comes to them with great difficulty. But I know Puzz gets very energetic and energized when my pitch level raises, and there's definitely a praise voice, and then there's a lower, not that. You know, and she knows the difference. So if yours is part golden, she's really sensitive to that high pitch and gets charged up by it. It may well be that, you know, that high voice is sounding pretty darn exciting. And she loves paper, too. So there may be a whole, oh, yeah, paper.
Okay, but this is the last question.
The same dog that we've been referencing would love to do activities that are work activities. And I tried doing, what do you call it when you go through things and over fences? Agility. And he loved it, although he could not pay any attention to me about where to go. And probably, therefore, I was the failure. How do you train a dog to do quite sophisticated things that are obviously very good for him or her, but are not so easy to train for?
Are you asking me or any of us? Well, you start small. You know, we call it chaining in search and rescue. So you start with a small event, a small training situation, and when they do that appropriately, you make it larger and larger and larger. If your dog was struggling with agility commands but seems very, very motivated to work, one of the things you can do is do some nose work. There are organizations all over the country now that do what are called fun nose works. And you can literally, especially if you have a leather key fob, you can literally teach your dog to find your car keys or find your missing glasses or whatever. And you start very small. Yeah, score. You start very small and reward very quickly. And it's amazing how quickly they will catch on if it's something they're already drawn to doing. So, you might have additional things to add, but yeah, give them a job. If they look like they want a job, give them one. And then when they get praised and they get to do it again, it's the best of both worlds. And you have your classes and your keys, and yeah, it's good.
So I want to thank everyone for coming. Andy is cutting us off here, sorry to say. But we will all be upstairs signing books, and we'll be happy to answer questions, especially if you buy our books. But even if you don't. So thank you all for being here, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.